State University. This is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. John Green's first novel, 2005's Looking for Alaska, won critical praise, the Teen's Top Ten Award, as well as the Prince Award. His 2007, An Abundance of Catherines, was a Prince finalist, and his 2008, Paper Towns, debuted at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list for young adults. It won the 2009 Edgar Award for Best Young Adult Novel, and according to his very recent, as of yesterday, YouTube video, made in Columbus, Ohio, I might add, it also won the American Library Association's Young Adult Library Services Association Teen Top 10. It was at number 1, beating out Stephanie Meyer's Breaking Dawn. Congratulations and welcome, John Green.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Sure. That's a very long title, by the way, of the award that you won yesterday.
The Young Adult Library Services Association's American Library Association's.
Yeah, I didn't know which way that went, but I'm glad that I got it all out without making an error. And I'm not going to mention that this is the 16th time we had to do that intro. Anyway, you mentioned in I mentioned your YouTube video in the introduction. Tell me about your Vlog Brothers, which is a very popular video series on YouTube.
Yeah, several years ago, at the beginning of 2007, my brother Hank and I decided to communicate only via video blog for a year. So every day for a year, we made video blogs back and forth to each other. And we did it to entertain each other, but we made the videos public. And then over the course of the year, the audience got bigger and bigger and bigger. And this kind of community developed out of it, a community, sort of a nerd-based community, we like to say. You know, nerds who believe in social activism and intellectualism and celebrating those things. And so ever since then, we've continued to make videos because we like the community.
Mm-hmm. See, now, at first, I thought your Nerd Fighters, I think is your name for them, I thought that was a street gang. And it turns out to be something entirely different.
We're pro-nerd.
Pro-nerd, yeah. Right.
Yeah. You only have to look at, if you look at either Hank or me, you'll immediately realize that we have to be pro-nerd.
Pro-nerd, okay. Well, tell me about, there's some rules to this.
Yeah.
And a couple of the rules are that if either brother misses something, you set yourself up for punishment.
Right.
Which suggests, an upbringing that really revolved around guilt or something. I'm not sure how all that works out. I won't ask that. But why the punishments? How did you come up with the punishments that you do for missing a vlog?
Well, the thought was that Hank and I both have a lot of ideas and follow through on very few of those ideas. So that if we had some kind of reason to keep going, to make a video every day, and if there was a threat behind not making a video every day, that then we would do it, okay. Which proved to be the case, actually. Punishment works really well. Negative reinforcement is extremely effective on me. So it's worked.
So that's why you work under deadlines for your books.
Yeah.
A writer, you must have deadlines.
Yeah.
Do the publishers ever suggest that they'll punish you in some way publicly, humiliation for not meeting a deadline?
If only their threats were that charming and funny.
Okay. Well, tell me about some of these publishments. I saw one where you did the constituent parts of a Carl's Jr. There was lard involved. There was protein powder, I think, involved. And your reaction, sadly, occurred off camera after you had mixed it in the mixer and then drank it.
Yeah.
The first sip was good. The second sip
was worse. The third caused me to vomit, which is more or less the way that I feel about Carl's Jr. when I experience it in reality. But no, the idea was that all of these people on YouTube had been paid to eat a Carl's Jr. hamburger on camera as product placement, and they'd offered it to us, and we'd passed because that's ridiculous. And so instead, I thought that I would eat, and I was having to get punished anyway, I thought I would eat the constituent parts of a Carl's Jr. burger to sort of show how massively disgusting it is, the actual thing you're putting in your body is.
I want to tell you that Carl's Jr. is one of our sponsors.
It's delicious.
So what's the favorite punishment that your brothers had to do? I won't ask yours, but what's the one that caused you? Because you're brothers, right?
Yeah.
And I know that when I was a kid, my brothers and I delighted in, injury to the other person.
Oh, yeah.
I was shot by BB guns, things along these lines. What's the favorite one that your brothers had to endure?
My favorite one is probably one that wasn't physically challenging but was massively humiliating, which was that we made him recreate the most embarrassing moments of his life using sock puppet theater. And boy, I mean, it was quite, you know, a lot of like bathing suits falling off at inopportune moments, falling off of sock puppets. It was, yeah, that one really stayed with me.
Okay. Well, I have a question from what I did today was I pulled the internet, that series of tubes that you're probably familiar with, and to ask people the sorts of questions that they might like to ask you. So I'll set it up that way and let you know that, you know, I don't have to take any personal responsibility for questions this time, and I'm pretty pleased about that.
All right.
So Jennifer Mylink McNeely is a internet person who wants to know, what advice would John Green to young kids who want to become authors?
The first thing I would say is that it's not an unrealistic career goal. It might be an unrealistic goal to become like wealthy or to have a sustainable income from writing.
To live as a writer, that's unsustainable. But you can write.
Right, and you can get published. And there are a lot of people who get published. You know, I used to work at this book review journal called Booklist, and we reviewed 400 books every 2 weeks. I mean, every one of those books was written by someone. And there's no reason that that any young person should be discouraged from the idea of long-form storytelling, because I think that that's going to be around. It's been around for a long time. I think it's going to be around for a long time. My advice for the actual like process of writing and learning to write well is first to read a lot. I think that's the only apprenticeship that we have as writers. I think that's the only access that we have to the way that stories have been worked on paper for a long time. And my second piece of advice is to tell stories to your friends and try to pay attention to when they get bored, because they will get bored, and that can help you sort of learn how to pace a story, which I think is one of the harder things, at least for me.
Mm-hmm. So do you do that when you're doing vlogs as well? Do you, because your wife, who does not appear on camera, and for this reason, is referred to as the Yeti.
Right.
Do you read stuff to her to get a reaction? She reads it. She's one of your critics. Is that how it works?
She reads both my stories, and I don't write out the vlogs in advance, but she watches them when I'm editing them and helps me condense things and condense ideas and sometimes refilm lines to make them clearer or smarter. But yeah, she reads everything that I write, which is something of a burden for her. I mean, I don't know that she necessarily enjoys doing it.
We should interview her.
Yeah, say, no, it'd be fascinating.
Of the books that John has written, which ones were the greatest burden well, to read and which one?
The problem is that she has to read the same thing over and over and over again, so she'll read, you know, 20 or 30 drafts of something. And
oh, you make her read all the drafts?
Oh, yeah,
too?
Yeah.
Wow,
no, everything.
That's harsh. Yeah. That's love.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm a lucky guy. And I'm also lucky that she's such a good reader.
Mm-hmm. What is, just out of curiosity, what kind of feedback does she give you, somebody that's that close to you in your writing?
She has to be a little nice, because we've got this marriage to keep going.
Right.
But she's always been very honest. I wrote the first draft of Looking for Alaska before we started dating. And when she first read Looking for Alaska, she was very honest. It was a very different book then. And I think it's a much better book for her being in my life and being in my writing life. But yeah, she's pretty straightforward. And she's not afraid to rank things either, you know? Like, I would never say which of my books is my favorite, but she's happy to say that.
She's happy. Okay. Like that was the John Cusack movie where they rank everything, you know, so she can rank the books. How does she rank, should I ask, how she ranks Looking for Alaska and your other books, Paper Towns?
She ranked Paper Towns first, I believe Looking for Alaska second, and Abundance of Catherine's third.
All right. Well, it shows that there's a progress, though. If you've got a new number one, like your new number one on the Teen Choice Awards, for which apparently there was a cage match between you and Stephanie Myers. I had heard about this, that there was... No, I'm just kidding.
That would have been great. I would have definitely won then.
That's a challenge, Stephanie Myers, right here from John Green, cage match. Anyway, but another question from Jennifer Mylink McNeely. Before you were first published, were you turned down, and how often?
I was turned down a lot for short stories and things I submitted. Looking for Alaska, I spent 3 years writing it and rewriting it before I ever sent it out to publishers. And it sold, it didn't sell quickly, but it didn't get turned down much because it takes people like 6 months to read anything. So by the time it started to get turned down, which it did, I'd already signed a contract. Okay. So that helped alleviate some of the pain of getting turned down.
Well, I've sold it anyway.
So, right. Yeah.
Tell me about that process. I'm curious. You said it takes them a long time to read it, but on the other hand, you said that you were working at a place where you did 400 books. You reviewed 400 books every 2 weeks. And how many books were you personally responsible to in what seems like a perfect apprenticeship for a writer?
It really was a perfect apprenticeship. I was reviewing about 6 books an issue on average. So, but I was reading probably almost a book a day. Probably reading about 5 books a week at the time. A lot of short stuff. Some picture, mm-hmm. a lot of picture books.
Okay.
But it brought the ranged from really academic books about Islamic history, which is my area of academic interest, to picture books about Confucius. So and I was blessed with also to be able to read really broadly, which I think helped shape my writing in important ways too.
Okay. One of our Facebook followers has a comment. I feel I get more from reading books rather than listening to them, as I think I can make mental pictures more easily because he's partially sighted.
Mm-hmm.
So would John Green recommend partially sighted people use audiobooks or one of the new ebook readers if the magnification is good enough? What's your take on sort of reading versus hearing it on your stories?
I think it's different for different people. I know people who listen to audiobooks and who have really rich experiences from listening to them. And, mm-hmm. and what I like about reading a text is that I'm able to stop when I want to, and I'm able to refer back very easily to mm-hmm. earlier parts of the text and contextualize whatever's going on for me. And so I find it a little difficult to listen to audiobooks just because I don't have a very good memory. So I don't always remember what happened 10 pages before mm-hmm. or 10 minutes before on the audiobook. But for partially sighted people, though, I think it really varies, at least in my experience, with people who are partially sighted, because some people really enjoy that kind of oral learning, and it's how they grew up, and it's what they're used to and what they like the most. And with some people, there's great, now we have these great ebook readers that allow for massive magnification, mm-hmm. And we have pretty big tablet-sized, and I think that's great, too. I mean, I'm a big believer in ebooks. I'm probably the only writer in America who says that, but I am.
Well, I noticed that on Amazon that you also have there's an MP3 of Looking for Alaska. Were you involved in that? I mean, who read that one? I didn't catch the, was that somebody you knew? It wasn't.
No,
you?
I didn't. It was no one I knew and no one I picked. But he was one of the 50 voices of the century, according to Audiophile magazine.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And actually, Alaska was a finalist for this, the Audi Award, which is like the Academy Award of mm-hmm. audiobooks, which was a great honor. It didn't win, but it was nominated. I thought he did a great job. I find it really weird to listen to audiobooks of my books. The most recent one, Paper Towns, was done by Dan John Miller, who is this musician I really like in this band mm-hmm. called Blanche. And I was really excited for him to do the audiobook, and I thought he did a really wonderful job. But it's difficult for me to listen to the whole thing on audiobook because it just feels really narcissistic.
Mm-hmm. I would think that you'd want to, when people visit your house, they're riding in your car, the first thing...
Play it in the background.
Yeah, you'd come to the door in the smoking jacket with the pipe, saying, oh, yeah, so I was just listening to my MP3. Come in. I hope that's how you greet them.
Yeah.
Well, since we're doing bad, impressions, we'll segue into a question from Greg Van Eekhout, who asks a really sort of academic question. If Paper Towns partially deconstructed Looking for Alaska, what would John Green deconstruct from Paper Towns?
That's a good question and a difficult question. Paper Towns was in a way an attempt to deconstruct some of the ideas about women that the male characters had in my first novel. Mm-hmm. Ideas that maybe I felt like I hadn't adequately played with in Alaska. There are probably things that I would deconstruct from Paper Towns, but I don't I don't know what they are yet, you know, because I'm still awash in liking it. But in a couple years, when I don't like it anymore, I'll know what I would.
Perhaps your wife should tell you what to deconstruct.
She'd probably have some good ideas.
Right, as you say, there's the she's very honest about it, which says to me, you know, that's an interesting code word.
Yeah.
Because when my wife is honest about something, I know that I'm in for it. You know, I don't like the way you did dinner. Okay, so we've got a tutor at the CSW Writing Center, Ann Zadinsky, has a number of questions for you, and she's reacting. She really liked Looking for Alaska, but she had questions about it that she'd like to ask you about, especially the female character Alaska, which is obviously the front of it. It's not a travelogue.
No.
People know where Alaska is. It's within sight of Russia, it turns out.
just across the street.
Just across the street, according to the most recent political stuff. But anyway, there are the characters in Looking for Alaska are Miles Halter, who's known as Pudge. I had to look up the name because I couldn't remember. He's, I think, Miles twice in the book.
Yeah, he's almost always Pudge.
Yeah, and then it becomes Pudge. Nicknamed so by Chip, his friend, who then becomes the Colonel. And it's not like a popcorn colonel. He's the colonel because he's got a sort of militaristic bent and is interested in pulling pranks on other people. And then there's Alaska Young, who's the main female interest in the character and the one that pretty much the sort of obsession of Pudge. And I think to some extent, every guy in the book.
Yeah.
You know, so because she's one of these very free, open kinds of characters. And
My friend Nathan Raven, who works at The Onion, has a great phrase for that kind of character, the manic pixie dream girl. And she's a bit of a manic pixie dream girl, particularly in the first half of the novel when everyone is still busy thinking that she's this sort of awesome, wonderful angel fluttering about.
And in the second half of the book, you know, she makes less of an appearance.
Yeah, she does
so
much
there's,
less.
and I'm not going to say anything more about that except that she's not quite in the second half of the book. But Anne's question is, in the book, it is clear that John Green expects / intends boys to react to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
But how did Green intend his female readers to react to Alaska? And that's one of those audience questions. As you're writing it, who were you thinking of? You seem to, from the timeline, you were not maybe that far away from the experiences that might have led you to write this book, because you went to a boarding school in Georgia.
No, in Alabama, actually.
In Alabama.
Yeah. Yeah, I was pretty close. I started writing the book when I was 22, and, you know, I was only 4 or 5 years out of high school. When I started writing the book, I knew that I wanted Alaska to be this kind of character who some people find very alluring and some people find very troubling. And in the end, the people who are troubled by her are more right than the people who are find her very alluring and who get drawn into her. There are a lot of people like that in the world, in a lot of ways, the character Alaska was based on my memory of my high school self. I mean, obviously, I'm not like a hot girl, but like other than that, she's troubled, she's angry, she struggles with depression, but she's also, you know, takes people on. She plays a role in a lot of adventures and has a lot of fun, which I felt like I had in high school. I was always getting into some kind of trouble, but I always fancied it very kind of sophisticated and interesting trouble in the way that teenagers like
with
me
with the smoking jacket and...
Yeah.
Coming back to that.
I had a smoking jacket.
Did you?
Yeah. So, I mean, that... You know, fortunately, I've left that guy behind.
I don't know that that's fortunate. I think that would have been great if you had worn the smoking jacket here, though we're not allowed to smoke in the building.
I don't miss that guy at all.
Okay, so another question. After Oscar Zeta Acosta's death, his good friend Hunter S. Thompson described him as too weird to live, too rare to die. Would you apply that phrase to Alaska?
Yeah, that's a good phrase. I mean, I think I think that this world is a lot more difficult to navigate for some kinds of characters than it is for others. And I think that if you there are some people with particular personality bents that make it really difficult for them to survive the world, to survive the world as it is. That great German word, Weltschmerz, the distance between the world as it is and the world as it ought to be. You know, most of us are able to live in that space and to understand that the world can't be as it ought to be, and to feel sad about it sometimes, but not to be consumed by that sadness. And I think other people can't do that, and I don't think that's their fault. And I think in many ways that's what makes those people so attractive to us, is that they, you know, they are idealistic, and they, you know, they're open to suffering, they're open to pain in a way that most of us try to protect ourselves from. And yeah, I think that I think that's a good line. I guess I would apply that to her.
Okay. You know, it reminds me of one of the tropes in the novel is that Pudge is really into the last words of people. And one of the ideas I had for when I knew that you were coming to town was I was going to take you to James Thurber's grave, who's probably our best known writer in Columbus, and his last words were something along the lines of God bless, God bless, God damn.
Yeah.
And then he died, you know? And so those are great last words. But James Thurber's gravesite is, it's a little nondescript. It's it's a small stone. Mm-hmm. So that brilliant idea I wanted to throw out there, but of course it didn't work.
Great. I mean, it's beautiful last lines. I mean, you know, when you can get lucky enough to have last words like that, I think it can really almost enhance your whole body of work. I mean, in some way, that also says a lot about James Thurber's whole career.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So, yeah, it's good.
Yeah. And he, there's a lot of stuff in Columbus you can go see, and maybe we'll be able to do that today or something. But it's really a great last line when you look at the arc of his life and sort of the difficulties that he went through.
Yeah.
I imagine my last words is something like, has anybody seen The Rat Poison? Whoops.
And that's Paul Claudel's last words were, Doctor, do you think it was the sausage? So... Let that be a lesson. You know,
if
you ever find yourself in a situation where you're saying, Doctor, do you think it was the sausage? Try to follow it up with something metaphorically resonant.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. I read that there was one of the generals that died, or somebody in Civil War, said his last words to the doctor, who said he had not performed an amputation before, or something like, we all have to start somewhere.
Civil War generals had a lot of great last words.
Yeah.
There was one whose last words were, how do I look in the face, which I think are just beautiful. Stonewall Jackson's last words were, let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of those trees, which is very nice. Mm-hmm. Robert E. Lee's last words were, strike the tent. It's good. I mean, yeah, I don't know what it was about that that era of American history, but it brought out a lot of good dying declarations.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to a lot of people whose last words are just, ugh.
Yeah, well, now, almost universally, last words are like, ugh.
Yeah, that's too bad. I'll try to be more. Which, it's funny, because in this novel, the main character, when there is a death of a character, there are no last words, really.
Yeah.
Because the character dies as it is off screen.
Yeah.
So,
and I think that's, but I think that's usually the way. And what I wanted to do with that was, you know, we'd like to think that we live in this historical world where we can record the things that happen, and we can understand them, and we can come to some kind of conclusions about that. But of course, you know, 3 days into your first college history class, you realize that that's not true. And if you think about it, it's not true of any part of our lives. I mean, our lives are, you know, really marked through very deeply with ambiguity. And I wanted to write about how and whether we can reconcile ourselves to that ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This would be by the way, I'm just throwing this out there for your career. Very good last words. If you chose to go now, you'd be fine.
No, yeah, should stop.
That's it. We're done. So the Alaska and the character of Margot. the leading female in your third book, Paper Towns, are very similar characters, and mm-hmm. I think that's what we were talking about with sort of some of the deconstruction mm-hmm. earlier. Is there a significance to the repetition of the beautiful, damaged, wild, desired, and tragic female lead? There's a lot of adjectives.
Yeah, accurate. Though.
Right. How do you intend female readers to interpret this depiction of adolescent girls?
There is a relationship, which is that because of the plot arc of Looking for Alaska, because it's a novel about death, I felt in retrospect like I wasn't able to expose the lie of this beautiful, damaged, larger-than-life girl that is so prominent in our culture. I mean, there's plenty of male versions of this as well, you know, the strong skin as cold as marble, sparkles in the sunshine kind of boy.
I'm not thinking of any particular vampires.
But the girl version of that is everywhere in our culture, and in a way, and it really troubles me. It troubles me because I think that in the same way that dehumanizing other people is unacceptable, I think that thinking of other people as more than human is unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like in Looking for Alaska, I didn't destroy that lie of the manic pixie dream girl in the way that I wanted to. And so Paper Towns was a chance to go back to the way that boys imagine girls and to show through the course of the plot that the only way to really have a meaningful relationship with anyone, whether it's a romantic relationship or otherwise, is to stop seeing them as more than a person and to start seeing them as a human being. At one point in Paper Towns, Quentin, late in the novel, the main character has to realize Margot was not a beautiful thing. She was not like a shiny, pretty object. She was a person. And that is the transformative moment for him, where he's able to then sort of understand what became of her.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're working on a new book, I understand, from Wikipedia, the font of all accurate information, all perfectly accurate information. Yeah. It's titled The Sequel. Is that right? Is it still titled The Sequel?
No.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Wikipedia, once again.
I don't know. It might still be titled The Sequel, but that was very premature of Wikipedia to report. I think I said that, I stupidly said that once at an event, and there was a recording of it, ergo, it's true. It is, it's one of those Wikipedia things where it's technically true, but I might have changed my mind.
Okay. Can you give us a sneak peek in it, or are you against the sneak peek? Because you've been burned now on
sequel. Seriously.
Themes are you working with?
I'm working on two stories. One is the sequel, which is a sequel to a fictional novel, like a non-existent novel, mm-hmm. In which a young woman survives the end of the novel and appears in our world. And then I'm also working on a desert island story that's sort of like a response to Lord of the Flies, I guess.
Okay. Lord of the Flies 2? This time it's personal?
Lord of the Flies.
Okay. Well, everybody's nice to each other.
Pretty much. Okay.
John Green's Lord of the Flies, yes. In which everybody is polite.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to ruin the book for people who haven't read Looking for Alaska. So tell me about having characters who go through extreme or traumatic events.
Yeah.
And that impact on other people, because sometimes, though, you know, you have a character that's a stand-in for a life change for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you work through that? How do you look at it and say, you know, I'm going to do this with a particular character simply because of that? But does that sort of enter into it, or I'm being incredibly vague?
Yeah, we can talk about death, I think.
Okay.
So when you have a character in a novel die, and that death transforms the lives of other people. There is a habit, not only in novels, by the way, but also in life. I heard this all the time. I used to work as a chaplain, as a student chaplain, actually at the Children's Hospital here in Columbus for about 6 months. And I heard that all the time, that, you know, this person's death was going to be a transformative moment, in some ways negatively, but in some ways positively, in other people's lives. And my thought was always, particularly, you know, not people in the hospital, but people talking to me, trying to comfort me. And my thought was always, well, that's all fine and good, but what about the dead person? You know, I suspect that I could have learned those lessons some other way without this person having to die, and they don't get to learn the lessons because they don't get to be a person anymore. And I'm really troubled by that in both life and in novels. And I tried really hard in Looking for Alaska to make it clear that the death of the person who dies is not not an opportunity, or not merely an opportunity for learning or for growth. Mm-hmm. Like, everything, I think Pudge says at the end of the book, like, I could have learned everything I've learned some better way. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that you can reconcile yourself to death that easily. But on the other hand, it's also a fact that, like, it is a transformative moment in people's lives. Not necessarily, I don't think it's always a positive transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a tough question. That really gets to the heart of, what I was trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you succeeded in that?
I don't know. I was young, man. You know?
Maybe that's why it's number two on your wife's top three.
It's possible.
Well, what's the best part about being a writer for you? What is it that gets you up in the morning because you get to write? And I think a corollary to that, or a follow-up on that, is that you've got the vlog stuff going on, and it seems to me that that's got to be easier than the writing. You get to be sort of playful on that. It takes you a little while. And how does that not distract from being a writer?
Well, I always had a day job, and I kind of like having a day job. So I think I sort of, when I didn't have a day job anymore, I created video blogging so that I would have a day job again.
Okay.
And so that writing would feel naughty and feel like cheating and you know, because otherwise...
So it has to feel...
If it feels naughty. Like a job, then, you know, why would I do it?
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Go get your degrees you can not actually work. Okay.
Get a job. That's my recommendation. But the best part for me is having readers. With the vlog, I make a video, I upload the video, and thousands of people comment on it in the first 24 hours, and that's mm-hmm. great. But the relationship that a reader has with a book is so much deeper. The conversation that you get to have with that reader is longer. It's it has much more breadth, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to play a part in someone's life for 6 hours or 8 hours or 3 days or however long it takes them to read the book. Like, that is such an incredible opportunity, and I know how much I value that as a reader. So being able to have a seat at that table with them for that time that they're reading the book, that's what I like.
And you get reactions in different ways. I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting about your interaction on Vlogbrothers is you've got these, like you say, these immediate comments.
Yeah.
Bam, they're there. You uploaded one yesterday, and I think it was an hour later and there were 261 comments or something like this, which I figure, who can possibly read the comments? I don't know if you, there's another vlogger named Community Channel.
Oh, she's a good friend of mine.
Okay, she's very, very funny videos.
Oh, she's wonderful.
I really like her videos. And but she apparently tries to read all this stuff.
She does. Yeah, she does read them all.
I can't imagine how she has time to do anything else.
I think her boyfriend reads some of them.
Okay,
but she reads a lot of them.
All right.
And we do read all our comments. And it isn't easy, and it does take a lot of time. But it's really valuable to me, because what I like about making videos is that chance to have the interaction with people. And I really I value the community, and I think that they're really smart people, and so I like talking to them.
Well, it's, my follow-up on that is the kinds of comments you get there tend to be short.
Oh, yeah.
Pithy, you know, obscene.
Right.
And but then you've got the comments that you get from your readers, which, as you're saying, you're engaging them in a much longer conversation.
Yeah.
Tell me about dealing with those kind of things, because you can read those short, pithy ones fairly quickly, even though there are a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them really strike me as necessarily... that engaging.
Right.
But fewer of them, I guess. I don't want to...
It's hard. It's a lot harder to read email, to be honest, because it's a lot longer. A lot of times the people who write me are saying things that kind of make me uncomfortable, happy, but uncomfortable.
What's uncomfortable about it?
Well, a lot of people email me about the... most difficult things in their lives, okay. and the most painful times in their lives, and what that and the role that my books played in those, hopefully positive role, and that's really meaningful to me and really important to me. But I also, it's hard to know how to respond to it, you know, because I haven't read this book since it came out, and I'm really, really glad that it's out in the world and that it is still making this impact. But I'm also kind of uncomfortable with the notion that I helped in any way, because I didn't. You know, it was the thoughts that they had reading the book that helped, and it's nice of them to reach out to me, but it wasn't really, I don't really feel very responsible for any positive outcome that they had. So that's tough.
Just the negative.
Yeah, I do. I always feel responsible
for the negative. Yeah.
I'm much more inclined to respond to an email if it's like, I hate you.
So that may lead into the next one. What's the worst part about being a writer for you?
Well, it's very isolating. And if I'm not careful, I can get pretty recursive. If you Google recursion, Google will say, "Did you mean recursion?" Which I think is the funniest joke in the whole world. Yeah. But I can get really, yeah, so I need to be drawn out of myself because I get really boring when I'm alone all the time.
What are your writing habits? I mean, how do you go? You said it has to be naughty, so apparently you're dressing in particular ways in the basement. I don't need to know that part.
I write in the basement.
But, well, you've got a video where you're shooting you in the basement. It looks like you're having, as you said, work done on the house.
Yeah.
And the basement is the only place left.
Yeah, the basement is about the only place we can live right now. So, but I've always worked in the basement. I've always worked in basements for some reason. I like it down there. I like it pretty, you know, quiet, no windows or anything. I also work in a coffee shop a couple hours a day just to try to be around people and be a little less isolated and alone with my thoughts. But I mostly work in the basement. And I work I try to write 3 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon.
So you're looking forward to people interrupting you at the coffee shop.
Oh,
that's the kind of human interaction you're looking for.
Oh, it's such a blessing. Okay. When someone's like, how do you use the internet? And I'm like, let me tell you.
Yeah. So that's why you sit there with a come hither look on your face in the coffee shop. Yeah. Please. Yeah. Come forward.
You put, like, I remember being in high school and putting Catcher in the Rye on, like, the corner of the table at the coffee shop in the hopes that someone would be like, oh, do you like that book?
Did you get a lot of that?
No, it never happened. No, never happened.
That's too bad. You probably need to have a different book, like Danielle Steele or something that would be...
Twilight.
all right. What's the best writing job you've had? What when you think about the writing for the reviewers, think about that, and that's sort of divorced from what you're doing now. I'm curious about as you've gone, because most writers have this sort of trail of writing things or writing-related jobs.
Yeah. My best writing job was an unpaid job long before I got published at this magazine called Not Mag, K-N-O-T Mag, that's long since deceased. But I was writing with all of these people I really admired, many of whom have gone on to have great careers. And I was just so excited to be a part of this online writing community and to read the great stuff that was coming out and, you know, to have an audience for the first time. That was, it was unbelievable. I'm very nostalgic for it, even though it never paid me a nickel. So,
well, now, why was it K-N-O-T? Was it about, it wasn't about knots.
No, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, it was like a Boy Scout magazine.
No,
where you learned
I don't know why it was called Knot Mag. But it was just this website run by a couple people that I knew through friends and other people that they knew through friends. And, you know, it was just a lot of writers I really admired and who were all, you know, sort of young and trying to establish themselves and trying to, you know, finish their novels and everything.
Did they finish their novels? Do you have names to drop?
I do. Claire Zuhlke, her first novel just came out, actually. Lindsay Robertson went on to work for Gawker and New York Magazine and Comedy Central. What is Will's last name? Anyway, he ran the most famous sports blog in the world, Deadspin, for a long time. AJ DeLorio, who now runs Deadspin, this famous sports blog. So, just a lot of people. And it's great. It's just great to see people go and succeed.
Okay. What's the worst writing job you've had?
I don't know if I should say.
Well, you don't have to give the name of it, but what's the, is it, was it because of the variety of it, or the kind of the genre, or what makes a difficult writing job for you?
I used to review audiobooks for like $20 a pop, and they're like 10 hours long, so the per hour pay was really bad on that. Honestly, the thing that I find most difficult in a writing job is if I'm doing it for money. I never like that.
Really, why is that? I mean, you're doing this for money, right? Or you're doing this for expression?
I'm not. Yeah, I mean, if I'm happy and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I'm writing as a gift, and then after I'm finished, I go and I can become a business person and like try to publish it and try to, you know, get the book to as many readers as possible. But I don't write novels to make money, and I don't. You know, the things that I like doing the most, I have to make them as gifts, or I'm not going to be happy. And so those few times when I've accepted a writing gig because I thought I needed money or I did need money, it's never been fun.
Well, that's funny because it seems like, I guess it takes away the naughty.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of something that like makes it makes it into a job, which is exactly what I have been trying to avoid all this time.
This isn't dirty enough.
Yeah,
I'm getting what I want out of it. There's a follow-up question here, and that's you've got the film options.
Yeah,
have been sold for a couple of your books, and I think you're writing a screenplay for one of them, right?
Yeah, I'm writing a revision of the screenplay for Paper Towns. I wrote a screenplay version of Paper Towns for Mandate and Mr. Mudd, the people who made the movie Juno a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I am now doing the first rewrite, and I'm sure there will be many more along mm-hmm. the way because I don't know what I'm doing.
Good job, Mr. Mudd.
I hope they don't watch. but I did that because I really liked the people, and I knew that if I was going to ever try to write a screenplay, those were the people I wanted to do it with. Because I was writing with, they made the movie Ghost World about 10 years ago, right, which is one of my favorite movies about teenagers, and I thought Juno was a great movie about teenagers, and I think they understand the sensibility that I have, and I like the movies that they make, and so I thought that would be fun, and it has been fun. Although unfortunately, I'm massively unqualified to write screenplays. But
what's the difference? I mean, why? I mean, it's just so dialogue and a little description. How hard can it be, really? You know.
Well, it's not the dialogue or the description that's difficult for me. It's structure. It's always been structure that is a challenge for me. I can write dialogue and description all day long. What I can't do is tell a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end. And that's really difficult for me. And that's at the core of screenwriting, like structuring it so that every moment of every scene feeds into something else. Mm-hmm. And I'm much more, I think, discursive in my writing.
Do you think the vlogging has helped with that, or it's made it
a little bit, maybe? But, I mean, it's so short form, you know, so right. I make a 3-minute video. Like, I can figure out how to structure a 3-minute video, but it's much more difficult. It's like trying to, like, parallel park a semi-truck or something. That's how I always feel. Like, I just, and I don't even know how to drive stick. That's how I feel when I'm writing the screenplay.
All right. What would you do if you weren't a writer? What's your fallback career?
Oh, banking? I don't know. Banking really appeals to me because I would love to be rich.
That may be the only time in the history of the world a writer has said, I want to be a banker. If this doesn't pan out for me, I'm going to a 3-piece suit.
I wouldn't really be a banker. I'd love to teach English.
Have you done that yet?
No.
Because that may be why you're... No, I'm
sorry. No, it's possible, yeah. But, I don't think I could teach writing. I don't know enough about it. I don't know how to teach it, but I would love... I don't know how to teach English either, but I love to read books and talk about them, so mm-hmm. that part of teaching English really appeals to me. I don't know. I'm really hoping that I can ride this until my wife can take care of me.
Oh, excellent.
My plan.
She's looking forward to that, is she?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
really high on her list of things. Take care of John.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rank his books. Take
yeah.
care of him.
Yeah.
What's your secret vice of an author or a genre? Who is it that it would surprise people that you read?
I used to read a lot of romance. I used to review romance novels. these sort of 19th century bodice rippers, which I just thought were fantastic.
Because there's a big market for 19th century bodice rippers?
Is there? Well, there is. And when I was a book reviewer, I reviewed, you know, whatever they gave me. Hmm. And sometimes it was 19th century bodice rippers, which I got a big kick out of. I have to say, I don't read them for fun anymore. I read a lot of... I don't know if that's something I should be proud of. Oh, I guess it is. I read a lot of crime novels. I really like mystery novels, and I tried to play with that in Paper Towns, and so I was really honored when it won the Edgar Award, because I've always wanted to write a mystery book, but I never thought that I had.
Is there another genre that you want to try that you haven't tried? I mean, you've done... These three books are in the young adult.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something else? You're sort of dabbling in mystery, not dabbling in mystery, but the Paper Towns has mystery. Is there something else that you've got? Maybe a vampire novel.
I'm not going to write a vampire novel. I don't think. I mean, you never say never, but I don't really... I find zombies a lot more interesting than I find vampires.
Why is that?
Well, because zombies are in the business of walking around aimlessly, doing whatever they need to do to continue walking around aimlessly.
And you don't have to structure that.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry. You can just write scene after scene of zombie dialogue and description.
Yeah. And then, I mean, it just ends with the apocalypse. So, you know, there, I've got my ending built in. I would like to write... I don't know. I'd like to have a long career in which I write all kinds of different things and alienate many different audiences.
Excellent. So. Well, you've probably done that by coming on this show, really, for both of our viewers. And, who's your biggest influence? Last question. Who really impacts you when you're writing? You sit down and you think, this is the person.
I mean, the writer who influences me the most... although I don't think it shows in my work because I'm not as good as he was, is David Foster Wallace, who I read for the first time when I was a freshman in college. I read Infinite Jest when it came out, and I just was completely taken with his work and his commencement address at my alma mater, not my year, but a couple years later, is like the most important speech in my life personally. So yeah, I would say David Foster Wallace, and also a sort of ethical guide as well as a guide in fiction, but you know, I have no pretensions of ever approaching his genius.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, John Green, for coming on Writer's Talk, talking to me. Again, the books are Looking for Alaska, Paper Towns, and the third most popular book.
Sarah's third favorite, An Abundance of Catherines.
An Abundance of Catherines, the third most favorite from John Green's wife, The Yeti. And you can check him out on YouTube at Vlogbrothers, and that's where you'll get to see him in action eating the constituent components of a Carl's Jr. sandwich and having a bad reaction to it. So again, thank you, and I hope everybody out there can check out your book.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.